On this episode of the pod, former Wynyard coach and player, business entrepreneur, and most recently the self-proclaimed lead guitarist of the highly popular Better Off Dad podcast, Shannon Bakes. Bakesy joins the pod to talk about his journey, including many parts of his story only those close to him would know, including coming from humble beginnings, living in a relative shed for a time while getting by as a family, while also dealing with an accident that his father had at work at the same time, which left him in a wheelchair. We talk about the good times, including success in sport, premierships, business success and fatherhood, as well as tough times he's endured along the way, including failed businesses and relationships, depression, and how bringing premiership success to his beloved Wynyard Football Club helped him get through. Anyone who knows Bakesy knows how engaging he is to chat to. He loves a red wine and he's an open book on his life. This one's got so much, including a couple of stories like stealing a president's boat, rollerblading in a mankini, and many other drinking stories which are a great yarn. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome back to the Talk Hard Podcast. I'm Jake.
I'm Briley.
I'm Sonny.
We hope you enjoy today's episode.
I've got half an opportunity here. I'm going to take it this time.
He sat there for two songs and he goes, he likes to shit up, and then he left.
When I die, I want everyone to have shots and I want you to use my coffin as the bar.
I collapsed and they couldn't find a heartbeat for a couple of minutes.
I would give everything, anything that I've got right now to hear my mum sing again.
Could just go into the house and do it and no one would care, but people do care.
He said, thank you for saving your life.
The Talk Hard Podcast with Brendan Hinkson.
Oh, mate, it doesn't get much bigger than this.
Shannon Bakes, welcome to the Talk Hard Podcast, mate.
Brendan, thanks for having me, mate. I've looked forward to this.
Me too, mate. It's I knew that you were down in Tassie not that long ago, but unfortunately the stars didn't quite align. It would have been good to have actually got you face to face. So,
yeah, I was only on the deck for 6 days, and there weren't too many days I would have been in good enough nick to do a podcast. I wouldn't have thought.
Few red wines, mate.
A few reds, few beers, few stouts, all sorts of different drinks. But it was a really good trip home, mate.
I reckon, yeah. Well, if you had have come into the studio, then you wouldn't have got the honour that I'm going to bestow on you now. You're our first international guest, so we get you on the technicality there. So
absolutely, yeah.
Now we know we've gone worldwide now.
Absolutely, you know you've made it the podcast world when you're doing it to the UK.
Absolutely. Now, mate. So previously, before we caught up, I sort of went through a bit of your history, and it's quite clear that you've worn many hats over your life. Whether it's athlete, businessman, coach, player, nude rollerblader, which we're going to get into later on. But have you got a more important job than being the self-proclaimed lead guitarist of the Better Off Dad podcast?
Yeah, it's a new hat, isn't it? That's a bit of a joke in our little podcast crew. Like Nathan Hunt, he's obviously the main man of our podcast.
And he's a drummer, isn't he?
He's more of a drummer. Just, they don't really offer that much. They just hit skins and, that's about all. Yeah,
but you'd be buggered without him.
Oh, you would be. No, he's a good operator, Nathan, that's for sure.
So you're the lead guitarist. And what did we say? I think James is the roadie because he just shows up and doesn't really offer much.
He doesn't offer much at all, mate. That bloke, you wouldn't get a nicer bloke, but as far as a podcast team member, he's not part of the team. We've ousted him.
Yeah. And how's it all going, mate? You're obviously enjoying the podcast side of things. Is that something you ever thought that you'd do?
Not really. No, look, I think it's like, we do enjoy it. It's just hard. You know all about it. It's just hard to be able to find an hour of time where you can, firstly, you've got to research what you're doing, and then to spend an hour or get out, because I'm in the UK.
Yep.
We've got that 9-hour difference, getting everyone to line up, then you get your guests to line up. Yeah, it's just hard work. But we'll tick over with it, mate. We'll tick over with it.
Yep, I was going to ask you about that. Obviously, logistically, it creates a few little issues with the time zone and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a genuine pain in the ass, to be honest. Yeah, but no, but it is. It's a really good outlet. In the past, when we were doing it all together, we'd end up all three of us, half cut by the end of the podcast, including the guests at times. So at least this way, there's someone that's not drinking on the pod to keep it sort of going going where it needs to go. There was a good one we did with Campbell Brown. Where I was sitting in a car park at some garden centre, just because that was the only place I could get reception. And Nathan, I could tell he was about a bottle and a half of Pinot deep.
He was pretty loose, was he?
Yeah. Oh, it was funny. And just, because we both know each other's way we roll. So I'll sort of giggle at myself. But anyway, no, it was good.
And the irony of that is, if anyone that hasn't listened to it, and I'd recommend that anyone does listen to it, there's a unbelievable situation that happens when you guys have got Brownie on the phone, and he actually gets pulled over, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, he's driving back from the airport. Yeah. He talked about this on the Brownie podcast. So
he did, I listened to that.
and he was driving back. He'd had 3 or 4 ciders in the airport before he flew back from Sydney. Sure enough, pulled over. We're listening to him being, breathed by the police live on our podcast. Jonathan Brown was talking about it, saying there's absolutely no way those blokes would have kept that hush-hush if you had a blown numbers.
Yeah.
It would have been straight to News Corp. Yeah. He blew under. He drove home. It was all good.
He did well. Yeah, it's a good good advertisement for driving and drinking and driving responsibly, isn't it?
Exactly.
All's well that ends well. mate, so obviously I'm really excited to get you on. I know a little bit about your story, and a lot of it I've sort of learnt just through listening to the Better Off Dad podcast, because you've dropped a few little hints about your life and that sort of thing. And a lot of people would know probably about your sporting achievements and business side of it and that sort of thing. But there's also a lot more to your story that I believe, which is one of the main reasons why I wanted to get you on. I really, really appreciate it. So we'll work our way through it. So it started back in 1980. You entered the world, mate?
Yeah, popped in, mate. Mum and Dad had gone for a jaunt to Melbourne. They'd sort of decided they want to get away from the small town winded lifestyle. And Mum got pregnant there, and I was born in Box Hill within the Hawthorne zone. So I always had ambitions of playing for the Hawks, but never quite cut it.
Yeah, you were too well hidden, mate. It's a wonder that you weren't on their radar.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, but so born there, and then moved back to Wynyard in about 2 months later, and most of my adult life there.
I was actually going to ask you why you ended up back in Tasmania. So your parents were from Tassie originally then, so that answers that question. Yeah. So they were always going to come back, were they?
Yeah, Mum was a Wynyard girl, Dad was a Burnie boy, and they just decided they'd sneak over and try life over there for a bit.
Yep. So I know your first stint in Wynyard, you stayed there till you were 19, but tell us a little bit about the early days, because you didn't sort of, your family didn't sort of have it on their own terms all the time, did they?
No, Mum was 22. She had 3 kids under 22, me and my 2 sisters, Ellen and Kelly, on the eldest. And it got pretty hard for them. So we lived in Somerset there for a bit, and then they ended up moving down to Rocky Cape.
Yep.
And we lived in my uncle's, I've said this on a pod, we lived in my uncle's garden shed.
Yep.
Not garden shed, it was like a fibro shed. And it was sectioned off into rooms with sheets, and Dad would like draw water up out of a well, like a tea tree stained water, and boil it on a copper for us to have hot water in a bath. And we shat in a bucket, and it was like, Dad said, it was, this is 85. This isn't like in 1955.
Yep.
And we lived it pretty simply there for a few years, and
what was the reasoning behind that, mate? Were your parents sort of doing it tough at the time, or did they just sort of want to save a bit of cash, or what was the thought pattern behind it?
I think they were doing it tough. They never let on to us what was going. We just it was just normal life for us. So we didn't think anything of it. We had everything we needed. Like we never went without. Mum and Dad went without all the time. I've got great memories from back then, 84 it must have been. But I remember Dad had take this bucket out of the long, it wasn't a long drop, it was just a bucket on a seat.
Yep.
Under a seat. And Dad would go and dig a hole and empty the bucket when it was full and put the dirt back on it, stomp on it. And I remember Dad was at work one day and Mum had to empty the bucket. Mum's dug this really shallow hole and just sprinkled a bit of dirt on top. And I said, "Go on, jump on it, Mum." She said, I'm not jumping on it. Good times. Good times.
Yeah. And I remember just from talking to you there before and just from listening to you on the podcast, your dad had an accident around that time as well, didn't he? So that obviously would have added to a little bit of the strain on your mum and the family. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was a workplace accident at the pulp. The old pulp used to be out there at where Bunnings is. And
yep.
Dad was. They used to pin these shipping containers together, so they'd the forklift would lift a side up.
Yep.
And then a worker would go in and they put a pin in each end, and then the forklift would back away. Anyway, the forklift backed away, and Dad's pin sheared, and the whole side of that shipping container like fell on him and like really knocked him about.
Yep.
And they've looked him over, like they've lifted the bloody shipping container side off him, and they've looked him over, and they said, "Oh, you've just got bruised ribs, mate. You'd be right." Sent him home, and
Jesus,
Dad. I remember Dad walking up this drive. It wasn't a driveway; it was just a bloody gravel path when we were at Rocky Cape there, and he was no good. And he said, "Oh, I've been sitting with bad ribs," but he'd actually crushed all his lower vertebrae in his spine.
Jesus.
So then we had like Dad was playing. Dad played a bit of cricket for Wynyard, and he used to bowl pretty good wheels. Had absolutely no idea where he's putting them, but yep. He could bowl pretty rapid. So he just went with it. Like, you know, I've got bruised ribs, just got to get on with it. And he was trying to play cricket and all this stuff, and he ended up in a wheelchair. And it wasn't great as a kid growing up with that, but we just made it. It was just normal for us. We just got on with it. Yeah.
So how did he end up? How did the wheelchair come about? Did it get to the point where it just got worse and worse, or did he just eventually go to the hospital and get it checked? Or,
well, obviously, in the end, so that he realised there was something not right, and then he's gone and had the scans and whatever, and yeah, he's crushed all his lower vertebrae, but he just wanted to keep. He was 24 or 25 at the time, and just wanted to, you know, crack in playing cricket and whatever, and tried, but just couldn't do it, and then ended up on a walking stick just because it was a bit easier just to get around, and then it just sort of started to really degenerate. It got to a point where he was in a chair and then had a full spinal fusion, so the bottom half of his back all got fused together, and then ended up in a wheelchair and ended up in a bloody electric wheelchair for a while, and it was just, it just wasn't great. And then, over a period of time, probably 8 years on, you know, things started getting better. Got out of the chair when we were a bit older. He's cranking away now. He's not great, but he's got his own little business where he does home renovations and stuff. So but growing up, it was hard. Like you look at your father son. Yeah, like I played mini league when I was right, and you'd have your father son mini league days, and I couldn't play in it because my dad couldn't play. So you'd be sitting on the sidelines while your mates were playing in them, and things like that were really hard. But generally, we made fun of the situation.
Yeah. Did you guys have to take on any extra responsibility as kids because, you know, your dad was a little bit out of action? I'm imagining that he was the sort of fella that probably used to do, you know, all of the, you know, all the, for lack of a better term, all the blokey stuff around the house. So I'm assuming that you probably had to pick up the slack a little bit.
Well, I could split 5 metres of wood by the time I was 10. So,
That's why you're such a big rig now, mate.
I'm not a big rig, mate. I'm big through the belly, that's for sure. But no, the work ethic and whatever you build from having to do that. I remember Dad, we had a block drain. I must have been about 7. And Dad said, "Righto, boy, you're about to learn how to dig a trench."
Yep.
So he sat there in his chair and he cut the sods out where this little trench had to go. He just sat in his chair and cut it out for me. He said, "Right, now you have to dig it down about 300 mil." And here I was, 7 years old, digging a, like, my son's 6, so Luca's 6. So, yeah, so that'd be like my little Luca out the backyard digging a trench. But it was just got on with it, didn't think anything of it. And it's just sort of, that sort of made part of my character up, I suppose.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. So what sort of learnings do you sort of take from that time? Because obviously it wasn't the stereotypical childhood. Like, you guys are probably thrown a bit more in the deep end than a lot of kids.
Yeah. Well, my mum, what a machine she was. So she was working a couple of jobs. She'd worked down at McCain. Dad ended up getting a big payout, but it was a long way down the track. Like, we're talking, I think I was about 16 by the time we got the money.
Yep.
Or he got the money. So it was irrelevant. So we just had to survive. So mum was working at McCain's from Wynyard. So she'd drive down to McCain's every day, but then she'd also work as a waitress in a Chinese restaurant in Wynyard overnight as well. So, you know, mum was an absolute machine, but it sort of meant we had to grow up as well. So we'd be, you know, we'd be making our own tea or lunches and breakfast or whatever.
Yep.
And helping Dad out. And yeah, but oh, don't worry, it was still fun. We had a freaking ball. Like we used to call him the fat thing in the corner, and like because he couldn't get in the in and out of the shower as easy as it was. You know, he might go a couple of days without a shower, and hair is a bit greasy, so we'd call him the Exxon Valdez and shit like this. Real 80s jokes, you know. So
yeah,
but no, look, we had fun, mate. We had a lot of fun, and we never wanted for anything. We always had, like, you know, best sporting gear I needed, or you know, best running shoes. Yeah, I never wanted for anything, that's for sure.
Yep. Isn't it funny though, like your attitude, like when you look back on things, it's what you make it, isn't it? Like you just got to make the most of what you got at the time. Like a lot of kids these days, I suppose, are probably a little bit more sport and a little bit more sort of mollycoddled and that sort of thing. If you threw them in that environment, they'd think they were in bloody Alcatraz. But, you know, yeah. Like you guys back then, I was going to ask you how you look back on it. Like you look back on it with fond memories and you know, you had a great childhood.
Yeah, no, absolutely, mate. Like there's those key moments that, so I remember talking to my dad at my sister's wedding, and he was trying to tell me something, and I'd had a couple of beers, and I said, well, and then I brought up how damaged I was, I suppose, like I'd had a couple of drinks, you know, so it was a little bit emotional.
Yep.
I just brought up how missing out on those father-son football games or, you know, getting throwdowns in the nets from your dad, like I just didn't. Well, he tried. He'd sit in a wheelchair and throw him as best he could, but I just didn't have that dad there. My dad was always available to me. So, yes, he physically couldn't do stuff, but he could talk with me whenever I needed him. So,
yep.
And drive me to every bloody part of the state for whatever sport or whatever we were doing.
Yeah.
Definitely great upbringing. Yeah.
It's funny, and that's another good lesson for a lot of parents out there as well. Like you can be physically seen to be doing all the good things, but I think it's more important to be emotionally available. Like it doesn't matter, you know, what you're physically giving them and doing them and buying them and that sort of thing. You've actually got to have time for them.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. Like,
yep.
As we talk about in our podcast, there's no way to dad. There's no, you know, this is the formula to being a good dad. But the best thing you can be is available and present. We talk about presence all the time because what's the point of being there but completely lost in whatever it is you're doing when, you know, I guess our role is to get these kids through to be the best versions of themselves and impact the world in a really good way.
Absolutely. Yeah, and look, we'll
got a bit deep there.
No, you're right, mate. That's what we do. But we'll talk about parenting a little bit later on. But just back to your childhood, you were quite sporty, weren't you? So you're into athletics first, is that right?
I guess so. Like I did the mini league thing, you know, from six. Cricket was just something I did in the backyard with mates and cousins, and like that was literally summer, winter. It was either or, you know. It's pretty standard. I think running was probably athletics and running are still my love. And I remember the Burnie Little Athletics Centre opened in 1990 at the Morris College, and we were part of the first, well, the pioneers of the Burnie Little Athletics Centre. And there was probably 15 or 20 of us there at the first ever event. And we loved it, absolutely loved it. That shaped my sporting work ethic, I think, because we got into it so young, we knew no different. So we liked, like as a 10-year-old training, it seems a bit foreign, but we loved it. We loved going to our training sessions middle of the week with different coaches and stuff. So athletics for me, mate, and then everything else sort of came after off the back of those foundational abilities you learn as an athlete.
Yep. And you used to go all right though with your athletics. You represented Tassie, is that right, in athletics?
Yeah. So, but that was, you know, unders, so 12, so I think we went to Perth. I was actually talking with a guy I went away to Perth with, Brody Holland, who's played for Collingwood.
Yep.
So we're about to get him on the podcast. Well,
excellent.
He went away with me on that carnival, and that's just an example of what little athletics does for your foundational sporting abilities. Like someone like him went on to be an elite. I think he won the premiership at Collingwood, athlete, but just. So little athletes in 12, when I was 12, and then away in Melbourne when I was 13, and then away for Tassie in the cross country when I was about 14, and then again 14 or 15 for athletics up in Queensland.
Yep.
And then I just sort of mentally I just didn't handle it. Like I was put too much pressure on myself. And
yep.
I'd gone for probably 4 or 5 years in the state without being beaten in the 1500 and had a state record. And
I was going to ask you that. So that was your blue ribbon event, was it? The 1500?
Yeah, 8 and 1500. I think I got beaten in 1800 over 4 years, and I don't think I was beaten in the 1500. But with that, because I was training via correspondence, I had a coach from Hobart. He'd send in the post my training schedule, and then I'd just go up to the soccer club in Wynyard and do my training up there by myself. And when you're 14 or 15, and I just didn't like Olympics is what I wanted to do, but that was still 6 years ago, 6 years away, the 2000 yep. Olympics. And my mates were playing footy and they come to school and they're having a great time. Oh, we played footy on the weekend and did this. And oh, I remember when someone did that. And it was just me just running, And I remember coming out of my bedroom about 14 or 15 and just in tears. I said to Dad, I said, I don't think I can do it anymore. And he said, well, you don't have to do it anymore, mate. You can do what you want. I said, oh, right, okay. So I just, that day, I quit.
Yep.
I think I might have gone away to the National Carnival after it. So I think I had a National Carnival coming up. But, made the decision. And then I just said, I just want to be like my mates and play team sports. So then that's where that started.
I was going to ask you that. Like with your personality, I know that, you're generally, one of the boys and like to be around people and a bit of banter and that sort of stuff. Do you think it just suited your personality more team sports rather than an individual one? You want to be part of a team?
I think so. Yep. I mean, when I was with like a team going away on carnivals, that was awesome because you had all your Hobart mates and your Lonnie mates and it was great, but you wouldn't see them very often, whereas I did it. Jen made me do a test. There's a narcissist test you can do online to see if you're a narcissist.
Right, yeah. Yep. That so could
be
deadly.
I've done the test. Well, I'll try anything twice. I've always said that. So I've gone on and done it. And I came back as a 80% narcissist, 20% something else. Anyway, so I've got that aspect of my personality where I need to be with people, and whether it's showing off or whatever, it's just how I am. I've just got to buy it. It is me. I've just got to go with it. So, yes, being in team sports allows me to express my foolishness and be a bit of a clown at times, but also that narcissistic aspect of your personality allows me to be motivated to be the best I can be because I want to prove to everyone that I'm the best at what, not that I am, but like want to be the best at batting, bowling, jumping, taking hangers, whatever it is, that's just that. Yeah, so I think team sports definitely catered more to that.
How scary is it in this day and age how much we rely on modern technology? It's not till your phone dies or the Wi-Fi or power goes off that you realise you'd be lost without it. Well, recently my phone decided in its old age to die and stop charging, and on a weekend no less. So what do? Rather than waiting to speak to the network providers or retail outlets, which can be painful within itself, give Brad or Katie a call at Greenies Apple Repairs. That's what I did, and they had my old phone as good as new in hours. Greenies take care of iPhones, iPods, iPads, and pretty much everything else, and they won't cost you an arm and a leg. So next time you're stuck back in the dark ages with no technology, contact Greenies Apple Repairs on 0401 229 220, or you can contact them at www.greeniesrepairs.com.au or find them on Facebook. Now just to get onto this busted screen. A lot of people on the coast would probably know you more recently for your footy exploits, but it was cricket that you were probably going further as a junior. Is that right? You ended up moving down to Hobart?
Yeah, so I was 19. I'd played 4 years of underage carnivals. And then Tim Coyle was coach, my under-19 coach at the time, and he said, time to get to Hobart, mate. We think you've got something to offer. So I went to Hobart, met with the University Cricket Club, and Enrico DiVenuto was actually my coach. He's the father of Michael and Peter DiVenuto. Michael yep. played for Australia. Peter yep. Peter actually played for Italy, cricket for Italy.
Wow.
Anyway, I met with him, and he said, right, it was just an amazing experience to go down as a 19-year-old, wide-eyed from Wynyard, and went and met him and said, yep, this is what I want to do. So then got a transfer from my apprenticeship. I was doing a Boilermaker apprenticeship at Elphinstone's. Got a transfer down to Incat, the catamaran builder down there, and lived at their customs pub for about a week or two while I found a unit to live in.
Yep.
And that was the start of my, life of being a gypsy.
And obviously anyone that listens to the Better Off Dad podcast, you know, you've teased getting Tim Payne on the podcast numerous times. Is this where he came into your life during that time?
Yeah. Well, he would have been, so he was 14 and I was 19. So 14, 15. Anyway, he was in and out of the A grade at the time. So I was playing A grade, played, like I had two really good years to start with down there. Won Kookaburra Cup finals and took a heap of wickets, didn't make too many runs. I played second 11 for Tassie, and I remember I'd taken a heap of wickets probably for about 5 weeks, and Greg Shippard was the coach of Tassie at the time, and I'd gone up to him, and I said, when am I going to get my shot? When am I going to get my shot? It's so arrogant. And he goes, what do you mean, mate? I said, I'm taking all these wickets. When am I going to get a shot? And here I am trying to say I should be bowling in front of Mark Ridgway and Sean Young and all this shit. And in the end, he goes, oh, look, leave it with me. And then that next week, I got a game with the second 11, played second 11 of Tassie. And, so that's sort of where, I met Tim Payne, and he was just his 15-year-old kid coming through. And then he I think he won the Cooker final with us. But he's just one of the boys. Like, I do cop shit. I cop a lot of shit for being a name dropper. But I name drop Nathan Hunt with these guys. Just, my mate Hunty did this.
Yeah.
Whereas as soon as I mention like James Faulkner or Jason Crazier or Tim Payne or bloody whoever, suddenly I'm a name dropper. But so look, like Zane Murphy or Zach Smith,
yep.
they're a couple of my mates, and I'll name drop them to these guys. And
it's just that your little black book's got probably a few bigger names in it than most people.
No different to most people, I reckon. But it's certainly good fun. But I loved my time down in Hobart at that period, and I actually lived. So I played. Dean Hills was my childhood hero growing up. Yep. He was a Wynyard cricketer. The Hills Cox opening partnership for Tasmania was the best ever, and they were both down there at the time. So here I was going down there. I just couldn't believe who I was training with, and say Mark Ridgway, Sean Young, Australian cricketers, Colin Miller. You'd be training with Colin Funky Miller, and that was during his time when he was playing for Australia. And
he'd be a different unit, wouldn't he?
Yeah, mate, he had different hair colour every training session.
Absolutely. The Dennis Rodman of cricket.
Absolutely, yeah. But, that was a real eye-opener. When you leave Little Wynyard, just think, okay, I'm a chance here. I could actually do this. Yeah.
Yep. And, from there, you ended up going over to Scotland to play, didn't you? Is that right?
Yeah, so Dean Hills was playing in Scotland, a cricket club called Greenock Cricket Club, and he said, oh, you want to come to Scotland? I said, oh, yeah. So that was in like February. And so by the end of March, I was on a plane to the UK. And, so that club actually had, say, Phil Simmons. Remember Phil Simmons, the cricketer? Yep. So he played the year before. Dean Hills was there. Gordon Greenwich, he was a pro there the year before that.
Wow.
I actually got to play golf with Gordon Greenwich in Greenock. Like, it was just one of these random things that happened.
Yep.
So I went over there when I was 20, I think. And, then I met a girl there after a couple of weeks and ended up got married to her. I ended up, that's how my association coming back and forward to the UK started, I suppose, sort of had that link after my cricket time.
Yep. And you told me in your notes that you sent through to me that it's where you learned to drink over there. So you weren't a big drinker before you went over to the UK?
Not really, no. I was pretty disciplined. Like, I wouldn't drink on a Friday night before a game of anything, and wouldn't drink midweek. I'd be just one night on a Saturday night.
Yep.
And by the time I got there, I could have 4 pints. By the time I got back, I was smashing 10 pints and barely even feeling it. It's just it's a genuine pub culture. And as an overseas player, you're expected to be the life and soul of the goings on after the thing and after the games. And it was absolutely brilliant. And that's the big thing about having cricketers come and go from the UK. So us go here and them go there. It's got to happen because it's just great for your relationships and club culture and all those things. So, yeah, no, I fitted right in by the end of it, that's for sure.
Your piss fit real quick.
Unbelievable. I remember, I think I got pissed 3 times on the way over on the plane. It was like in Melbourne, the airport. I'm 19. Here's a guy called Tony Judd, Dean Hills, and Dan Marsh. Dan Marsh used to captain. So we were all in the Melbourne airport drinking piss. And then Brad Hodge, he suddenly turned up. He's drinking with us. And I'm like, I just couldn't believe I was with these blokes. Anyway, but yeah, so I was pissed in the Melbourne airport, hungover between Melbourne and Kuala Lumpur, and then pissed from Kuala Lumpur to Vienna, got out there, went into an Aussie pub, got on the plane, hungover from Vienna to Manchester, and then in a car up to the Greenock Creek Club in Scotland, and back on the piss. So I was like pissed 3 times without sleeping. It was terrible.
Not good preparation.
No, anyway.
How soon was your first game when you touched down?
Yeah, we played a friendly game that week against an Irish touring team.
Yep.
And I think I got 50-odd and took a heap of wickets, and they thought, oh, this guy's going to be all right with the bat. And I didn't make another run after that. But they had a local rule. You had to clear, like you hit the ball over the rope, you'd think it'd be a six. But it's not. You have to hit it out of the ground for it to be a six.
Right.
So it's only a four. So I hit this ball on the back of the club rooms, and the umpire's like signalling four. Well, what the hell's that all about, mate? He goes, no, it's got it. And then they told me the rules. So they reckon Gordon Greenidge was hitting balls and was clipping trees on the way out of the bloody stratosphere, and they were just waving four. He wasn't happy with it.
I don't reckon. Putting your best work into it, not getting rewarded for it.
Yeah, but a lot of cricket, mate, over here. It's like you had midweek games, Saturday, Sunday games. It was just brilliant. Great cricket over in Scotland, yeah.
Yeah. Have you got any good stories from the club rooms? Like, obviously, you would have had a bit of fun and stuff. Anything you can share?
Yeah, I remember we started a fire out on the out next to the club rooms one night. We were all a bit cold, and we ran out of wood. So and the captain kept this, the club president kept this wooden boat there for some reason.
Oh, no.
And so we burned a few 8-ball cues, cut the cricket bats, and we were really running low on wood to keep warm. So we grabbed the president's boat and just sat it on the fire and burnt that as well. Unbelievable. Anyway.
How'd that go down?
I can't remember. I think we got away with it because we were doing well with the bats. I'd probably take the six for some, got away with it.
If you were losing, it might have been a different story. You might have been on the first plane back.
Absolutely. We actually lost all of our points that year at the back of the year because they found loopholes. We had six or seven overseas players. You're only allowed two, but our club had that much money. They were finding people with half British passports and getting them over and paying them an absolute fortune.
Yep.
And we all got found out, and it's like when Carlton was playing all these players. Yeah, got all our points taken off us. I think we even got relegated that year, but we never lost a game.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. Anyway,
fair old time. Yeah. How long were you over there for?
I did. So I was 6 months the first time, and I came back and lived in Scotland for nearly 2 years.
Yep.
And then moved back to Tassie after that. But
yep.
And then it was just a case of coming and going. You'd always do your 2 or 3 month stint or whatever.
So you said, was it after a couple of years of sort of bouncing back and forward to from England to Tassie, then you moved back permanently to Tassie, and then you sort of bounced back and forward from Hobart to Wynyard for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, it was a block of time where I was, I think I bought a house in Wynyard about 2003 for 60 grand.
Wow.
And I remember we bartered over the couch and the lawnmower. But anyway... But yeah, then my wife was, she was a building surveyor, so she wanted to get to Hobart to sort of spark her career back up.
Yep.
Because she's living in Wynyard, just doing whatever. And we moved down there and, you know, went back playing cricket at uni. And I think I played a bit of footy at Hutchins at that point. But I did travel from Hobart to Wynyard for a season in 2005.
Yep.
Played footy for Wynyard from Hobart. I remember left Sandy Bay one day at about 7 in the morning, drove to Smithton, played the game, then drove back. I got home about 10 o'clock that night, straight out on the circuit in Hobart. But I loved Wynyard that much, mate. It didn't worry me. I had a really good year too, because I didn't train during the week. I'd play on a Saturday.
Yep.
And then I'd just go for a run on a Thursday. And so I was fresh every week, and best season of my life.
Yep. Yeah. We'll talk a bit more about your time at Wynyard when you were coaching and that sort of stuff. But you moved to Launceston then and actually played in a premiership up in Lonnie, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, so we moved. The wife got a transfer from her job in Hobart for whatever reason. And, I was living in Lonnie, and I'd sort of tried to travel to Wynyard to play, but it was just too hard. And
yep.
Adam Sanders was coaching Launceston at the time. Launceston had a super strong team, and
yep.
I just thought I'd try myself, because I was living in Lonnie, try myself at a pretty decent club. And
yep.
yeah.
Were they in the NTFL at that stage, or were they in the statewide?
No, NTFL. Yeah. Yep. So there was no statewide. It was the NTFL was so strong at that point. There was, you had North Lonnie, South Lonnie, Launceston.
Burnie was still strong then too, I think.
Burnie was strong, yeah. Well, Justin Platt was coaching Burnie.
Yep.
But I played in the 2008 Premiership with Launceston. That was such a very important thing for me to experience going forward for my coaching.
Yep.
Because Adam Sanders was a psycho. Like, he was so harsh, so hard on us.
Yep.
But he taught me all these things about what you had to do to be successful. And yeah, and when I went back to Wynyard, I took a lot of that with me, I suppose.
Yep. So it's a lot of the ways that he coached, you sort of took that into your coaching. Like, did you drive him pretty hard? Did you?
Yeah, I did. I'd also hug him. He'd be that lead a donkey with a carrot on the end of a stick, or you can hit him with the stick. He used to hit us with the stick all the freaking time.
Yep.
But so I could give him a whack, but give him a cuddle at the same time.
Yep.
And I think that's why it worked okay at Wynyard, because if you just try whacking blokes, well, it doesn't work. So
yep.
So I lived in Lonnie, and then I actually moved back to Hobart for whatever reason. And then at that point, man, the ex-wife actually went through a divorce.
Yep.
Or started the process of a divorce. So
yep.
That was in 2010. So I was living in Hobart in 2010, and in a pretty bad way. I'd had 5 years on antidepressants at that point. There was a few things with the ex-wife that weren't going real well, and
yep.
It just really rocked me, really. And at that point, that's when Darcy Leno, who was the president at Wynyard Cricket Club, said, "Righto, matey, time to move home, little matey."
As he would, yeah. He was a character.
Sucking on a dart, landing on a wheelie bin.
Yeah.
I said, "Yeah, righto, Darcy, whatever, mate." Yeah, I'd sort of, no, I'll think about it, mate. Hung up. And I was working in a little workshop. I had like a business. I had a business in Hobart, just boiler making business. And I thought, I think he's right. I think it's time to go home. So I said, rang him back, said, "Right, I'm coming home." So I just ended up renting the house out. The wife was living in Lonnie, so that was all done and dusted. I had no reason to be in Hobart by myself, so I just moved back to Wynyard.
Yep.
Moved into Mum's front bedroom.
Yep.
All I had was my so this is the thing. I went from having everything, so I had absolutely killing it. Me and the ex-wife were very, doing really well. And then my business started to struggle in about 2010 with the GFC, and there was no money in Tassie at the time. All the Kevin Rudd schools had stopped. And I was doing a lot of them, and the forestry industry had fallen over. I had a lot of logging contracts. So I had all this gear I had on hire and on leases, and yeah, so I ended up in a very, very bad financial position at that point, plus lost the wife, plus, you know, lost my houses. so moved home with a bedroom setting, a 42-inch plasma, and a computer. And that was all I had out of like eight or 10 years of marriage. And I was in a pretty, pretty bad place. But that was the beauty of sport and Wynyard and the community that that sort of saved me from myself, I think.
Yep. I was going to ask you that, and, you know, not to sort of go back and dwell on it too much, but how dark were your days? Like, what were your bad, really bad days like?
Pretty bad. Like, because I was pretty broken. Like, I was smitten by this person, whether it was healthy or not. I do remember one day I may have had a few too many sleeping tablets one night with a bottle of red. That was a sketchy one, but yep.
Sketchy, yeah, in what way? Like, did you?
Well, it was probably a bit risky. Like, I don't think I did it to try and top myself, but
yep.
I think I must have sent a message to a mate saying, "Oh fuck, I might have overdone it a bit here." And then I woke up the next day, and there was that mate in my bedroom, and he's like, "You're all right." I'm like, "Shit, yeah, righto."
But, so, what did he just come over and watch you to make sure you woke up? Did he?
He woke me up. Like, yep. And I'm like, "Oh, what's going on?" And then I was like, "Oh shit, righto." But then word had gone around to someone else, and it's like, "Oh shit, this is not ideal." That's as dark as it got, but it wasn't that bad. Like, I just think it was just a bit risky behavior. So that was probably the lowest. And then that was all up from there, wasn't it?
And that's what I was going to say, because you come across now such a bubbly, sort of positive, happy sort of person. If anyone's listening to this that is in one of those really dark holes, when you look back on it now, you say sport was one of the big keys to get you out, but were there any other key changes that you made or anything that you did that you say, geez, I'm glad I did that, that dragged me out of that?
Antidepressants.
Yep.
Like, there's a real stigma about them.
Yep.
But you can, look, there's absolutely no doubt that they work. And when I was on them, initially I was embarrassed, but then in the end it's like, well, I'm doing all right here. You know, I ran a business. I had eight blokes working for me. I was on antidepressants the whole time, but I was, you know, I was managing, you know, and yeah. I'd try and go off and then I'd have a bit of a crash. And then I thought, oh, I'm never going to get off them. But then, you know, along comes sporting Wynyard and my beautiful wife, Jen, and things started getting better. And, you know, then, you know, I took on the cricket job first and then the footy job second, so I was doing both cricket and footy at the same time in Wynyard, so I was fully focused. I had things to keep me in mind active, probably a little bit too much, and yeah, there was probably a bit much for Jen too. She had enough because I was training 5 nights a week and playing cricket, footy Saturday, Sundays. And she left me, actually. She moved back to the UK halfway through 2012, but
yep,
went on, won that premiership with Wynyard in 2012. And from that day on, I never took another antidepressant, like literally from that day. So I would have had one in the morning, threw the prescription out, and that was that. So footy, I think that premiership fixed me, along with the support of Jen when I eventually went back and got her on the Wednesday after the premiership. I flew back to England and asked her to take me back, and she did, thank God.
It's like something out of a movie, mate. So she'd taken off and you won the premiership and thought, right, I've done that, so now I've got to get the missus back.
Absolutely. No, she it was hard on her, really hard, because I mean she had to experience my a divorce, so that was going on the side, me coaching two clubs, just a complete lack of a partner at times, and she was by herself, and it just got too much for her, and she went back to England. And then we sparked it back up while she was over there, and then it was a case of just finishing the season and getting there to re-spark us.
Because I was going to ask you that. So she's from the UK originally then, and she'd come over here. What was she in Tasmania for?
She met a guy from Wynyard, she came out with him. He played cricket in the area.
Yep.
And then they split up. For whatever reason, she lived in New Zealand for a while, and then when she came back from New Zealand, I was single, and I thought, oh, might as well have a crack. I'd been setting her up with all my mates, and in the end, I'm like, why am I setting her up with everyone when she's such a belter? So in the end, I thought, oh, well, I might as well I might as well have a crack.
Thank God for that first Wynyard bloke, a dragon, a back to Tassie then. Must be something about those Wynyard guys.
Yeah, left-handed Wynyard blokes. They're all those.
So we'll just touch on your premiership. So you came back and did you coach Wynyard in 2011 firstly, or was it 2012?
Yeah, 11. So Hunt coached, Nathan Hunt coached in 2010. Yep.
And handed you the keys to the Ferrari, he tells me.
That's what he says, yeah. So he did have a good young list, but just missed a few key post players.
Yep.
So then I took that 2011 team. We lost the first seven games, I think, six games, something like that, and it didn't look like we were going to make finals. And then we went on this run, and we were beating everyone. We beat Latrobe last round of 2011 by 70 points on the Latrobe deck, and we missed out on finals by 2 points.
Yeah.
So we were red hot then and could have done anything, but didn't make it. But that year really sparked us, and we had built an amazing committee that year with Tom England, and you know, our strength off the field was what gave us real strength and focus on the field. So 2012 hit, we recruited Sharno back to the club, Craig Stretton, Scott Matheson. You know, we had that core of Zach Smith, Sam Douglas, Bryce Hanavir, Reece Phillips, just an unbelievable midfield. Cameron Betts, George Walker, just heaps of talls. That team, in my opinion, would have challenged any team in the state at that point.
Yep.
So we were really lucky. Yep.
And I was going to ask you about in 2012 whether you could feel that something had changed, but you knew at the end of 2011 that you had a pretty special group. You just had to keep them all together, I'm assuming.
Oh, absolutely. That club was running like an absolute business. So they were doing 150 mils a night out of sort of from Thursday through Sunday. We'd call the teams out. There'd be 60 or 70 supporters there watching us call the teams out, plus 60 players every, you know, Thursday night. It was unbelievable.
Yep.
We loved it. We absolutely loved it. And everyone bought into it. No one was there for money. You know, we had to pay subs, you know. We were introducing things like that. So, yeah, we all bought in, and that's why we had the success.
Yep. And obviously, that Wynyard hadn't won a premiership for a long time. I think my research said it was their first flag since 79. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, it was 33 years, yeah.
Yeah, yep. So what did it mean to you guys, or to you in particular, to bring success back to the club again?
Honestly, I remember the song. I played fullback that day, and I remember calling the boys across to the wing to cover something that was coming down. I'm getting chills just thinking about it, mate. Honestly, yep. I remember the siren went, and I just melted into the ground, just like, and it was just, and Franksy, we just had our reunion, and Franksy was recalling, he jumped on top of me, and he said, I was just wailing like a child, like I was just screaming. I'm welling up thinking about it. It was unbelievable.
Yep.
Just, yeah, it's just such an important thing for so many people at that time.
Yep.
Oh, just amazing.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's actually
said. I can't believe I'm getting emotional.
It's all right, mate. It's actually set the club up too, hasn't it? Because they've been successful ever since. Like it sort of changed the culture around.
I think we had Errol there 2 years later. Errol had 2014-15. He backed back premierships there. But having someone like Greg Sharman at your club, given where he's come from, and he introduced the academy. I think that was with Kent Jackson at the time. I think Kent Jackson, Sharma started the Cats Academy. So suddenly you've got these kids training, doing extras and all. You know, your Zach Marshalls went through the Cats Academy and he's one of Wynyard's best players. And we, at that time, we really invested in our juniors and we treated them like us. Like I remember driving Zach Marshall home when he was 10 from a Smithton game. I called into Killinort cafe there out near Boat Harbour.
Mm.
I set him up with me at the bar. I got him a hot chocolate and I had a glass of red. I was like 32 and he was like, I don't know, 10 or 11 or something like that. And I just talked to him and just treated him like a normal person. But everyone did that. No one thought they were better than anyone. And that's probably why kids have stuck around.
Yep.
And yeah, it was just a really good time.
Yep. And I always ask, I've had a few people on, you know, that have been premiership players and premiership coaches. How did it feel going back to the club that night? Obviously, it was at La Trobe, the game, and then to go back to the club. Just describe walking into the club.
Well, I got sent a story written by Bill Walker, who was on our bus. He was the only supporter on our bus, and he wrote an actual timeline of what happened. And I read back through it the other day, and because a lot of it I'd forgotten. Like, I wouldn't let anyone drink. We were so disciplined. I wouldn't let anyone drink on the bus because that was unfair to the bus driver. And his life depended on his bus license, you know.
Yep.
And the boys respected that. So we were still disciplined right to the end. We called into the gentleman's club. We had one drink at the gentleman's club in Burnie because they were a big support for us, for whatever reason. Then we walked in through the roller door on the side of the club rooms and got called into the club one by one. I reckon there was 500 or 600 people easy at the club, probably 1,000 people outside. They were everywhere. And yeah, we felt like we felt like freaking heroes, mate. Honestly, it was just amazing. And the boys were so well behaved for the 3 or 4 days on the piss. The police actually rang the president, Tom England, and commended the club for the behaviour the boys showed over those 3 days.
Yep.
You know, we were sitting on the bloody balcony at Saberbuck. Steve Charles, who owns Saberbuck, goes, "Come on down, boys, I've got a carton of beer for you." So we sat up on the balcony and drank beer on the balcony of Saberbuck. And
yep.
One morning I ended up drinking red wine. Monday morning I went into Les Allen, his house, sat with him first thing in the morning before he went to work and had a glass of red wine with him before he went to Maris. He was the bursar at Maris. He sat and had, a red with me before work because he just wanted to celebrate with me.
Yeah.
It was just, something else, mate. But,
And that's the thing with premierships too. You don't realise how much it means to everyone in the community, not just people that are involved in the club. Like, it just means so much to the town, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
What kind of coach were you?
Boys would say I was bipolar. I think because I played as well, so I was a playing coach. So I wouldn't ask them to, I'd flog them up in the running. I'd beat them in the running. Well, I come from a running background. So you had all these young Bryce Hannavies and Josh Whitehouse just trying to beat me. So I think we're competitive. I'd hug him. I'd hug him big time, but I'd also let them know when they needed to pull their socks up.
Yep.
I got reminded of this and I was weird, really weird. We did so many just random things. I was reminded of a call, 3/4 time on game. I said, I don't know where it came from. I said, you can't always drink red wine, boys. Sometimes you got to drink stout. I don't even really know what it means, but I said it. It's just one of those weird things that I said. But anyway, But as a coach, I was all right.
And what's your philosophy on coaching? Is it to be firm but fair, but then give them a bit of a cuddle when they need it sort of thing? Or?
I think getting the right people in the right positions. So I had an unbelievable bench coach in Daniel Smith. So I'm no football expert, but he was.
Yep.
He wasn't going to be able to coach a senior side in his own right because for whatever reason, but my God, he knew the game inside out. So that was the key, having people like that in those positions. You're more of a manager. You weren't a coach, you're a manager. You were making sure that the club was running well. So, I don't really have a big ethos on just hard work. I think it's simple as that, isn't it?
Yep. Last one on your playing, mate. I'm a big numbers man. I remember when you played, you wore number 80. Now, I'm assuming that wasn't a number that just got rolled out on Guernsey night. You would have had to have requested that specifically. How did that come about and what's the thought pattern behind that?
I used to wear 29 and then Clint Robinson came to the club. He was the son of Colin Robinson.
Yep.
And this is the way I remember it. Suddenly, I might have been coming back from Scotland halfway through the year or whatever. And they said, "Oh, no, we're not saving 29 for you. We're giving it to Clint Robinson because of father, son." And I was, fuck is that? I'll wear number 80. No one was going to take that off me. So then I started wearing number 80. And then that was that. Yep. So I wore it my whole career,
And I think they still use it, don't they? Does somebody still wear 80? Yeah, somebody did after you left.
Yeah, I remember I handed it over to Mickey Linnane.
That's right. He was a fair player, too.
Yeah, he was a good player, but yeah, I don't think he cared too much for it. Yeah.
Just quickly, you coached him again in 2016, too. How did that come about?
Me and the wife had been all over the country working, just traveling in a camper van doing shutdowns, and managed to get pregnant with little Luca, and we moved back to Tassie to Shearwater.
Yep.
And when you were struggling after Errol to find anyone that wanted to coach, I don't know why.
Yep.
But Sharmo rang me. He was co-president at the time with Clint Strett, and he said, "Oh, can you come back and do another year?" I said, "Oh, yeah, why not?" So signed up for another year, and then moved back to Wynyard. But that's how I ended up back in Wynyard. I'm literally a gypsy, mate. Who knows where I'll be this time next year.
This episode of the pod would not be possible without the support of Sam and the team at Infinite Joinery and Design. If you're like me and normally need these guys to come in after you stuff up your latest home renovation, here's an idea. Get them in first and save the hassle. Specialising in new home joinery fit-outs, renovations, kitchens, laundries, wardrobes, vanities and solid timberwork and project management, Infinite have 3D design software, and Sam alone has over 20 years' experience in joinery and project management. He knows his stuff. Located at 6 Bay Drive, Coiba, or you can find them on Facebook and Instagram, or contact Sam at 0429 291 008, or you can email Sam at infinitejoineryanddesign.com. So don't be like me, get the experts in first and save yourself some money and a fierce dressing down from the better half. With all your moving around, like, where's home for you? Where pulls at the heartstrings for you?
Wherever my kids and my wife are. That's a genuine.
I'm
happy here, really, really happy here. As long as I'm with them, I'm not too bothered, mate.
Yep. And obviously, just talking about parenting, obviously that's the big focus of your podcast. What sort of dad are you? How would you describe yourself?
A bit weird. I think it's like everything I do. I think I try hard.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know what sort of dad I am, really. I just be nice, and just be nice to the kids, and yeah, they'll probably be nice back. Fingers crossed.
Hopefully.
Yeah, but it's just all about making sure them morals and ethics are drilled into them. Like, I was lucky; I had great morals and ethics drilled in by my parents, and you know, don't lie, don't cheat. Just that's about it, really. It's about all you can do. And we literally learn through doing the podcast, fatherly things, like things that other dads do, things I've implemented. Yeah.
Yep. And that was one of the things I was going to say, one of the things that I love about the podcast. I think there's so much self-help out there in this day and age, and how to do this better and how to do that better. But I think the realness is sort of lost a little bit sometimes. You know, we all fuck up as parents, don't we? Like, you know, that's part of it. Yep. And I think one of the beauties of your podcast is it's real. It's just, you know, three dads fumbling through, happy to admit, yeah, I cocked this up, I cocked that up. I think there's just a big perfection complex out there in society today. You've got to be so good at this because everyone's putting out there on social media they're the perfect parent and that sort of thing, but there's no such thing.
It's an absolute wank at times. Some of the shit you see on Instagram and all that, it's just God, it does my head in, but it's a reality of the world we're in. Don't worry. But I'll tell you what, it's not often I put up a post of Jen yelling at me about not Clem doing a nappy. Like, I'm not going to put that up on social, so I'm just as bad as everyone else. But, So apart from that, it's all pretty good.
Yeah. And just tell me a little bit about your kids, mate. So you had Luca in 2015 and then you had twins in 2020, is that right?
It's absolutely horrible. COVID had just hit. Jen had just started a salon in the guts of Wynyard. I was flat out with a particular business I was working for, and it was horrible, absolutely awful. 18 months of it was hell, absolute hell on earth. Just really lack of sleep. I lived in a granny flat for 3 months with one of the twins because they just kept waking each other up, and Jen wasn't getting any sleep, and that was absolutely awful. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but it's good fun now. So they're two and a bit now. So it's pretty much the whole time we're in Wynyard. That last stint we're in Wynyard, it was just absolutely bloody horrible. We got through. Then when the COVID sort of lifted, we thought it was time to get over to the UK so Jen's parents can spend some time with them.
Yeah.
No, they're good fun now, mate. Yeah, Luke is an absolute treasure. He's such a good soul. He's such a great help. He's a really, really good little lad.
Yeah. Excellent.
And I've got Oak and Arvie. They're the two twins. Oak's more like Luca. And Arvie, I think he is Satan. I'm pretty sure he is the devil. So
you have to bash that out of him.
Oh, yeah, flog him, don't you? Nah, he's so funny. He's so funny. He knows when he's doing shit wrong, but we'll work our way through that. Got 20 years to sort him out.
So they're twin boys, or is a pigeon pair you got?
Yeah, twin boys, two identical. Yeah, three boys. So yeah, that's the other thing. As dad, geez, you've got a responsibility to make sure they respect women. My dad brought me up. You must respect women. You must respect women and never strike a woman. All these simple things. But there's such a responsibility as dads of boys to, you know, make sure that women are respected. Yeah. I've got mates that play absolute players and absolutely treat women like shit. And I don't want my boys to be anything like that.
I was going to ask you that. Is there anything else that you sort of hope for your kids, like for their futures? Like when you sit there, what sort of people do you want them to turn out to be?
Just happy, mate.
Yep.
If they're happy, I'm happy. Like little Luca, he hates cricket. Don't play cricket, mate. You don't have to. His granddad over here is devastated because he's 60 odd, still playing cricket, and wants Luca down at the cricket club. Luca likes a bit of running, so we do the park run. I think he's probably going to be an intellect, to be honest. And then you look at little Oaky. Who knows? He could be anything. But Arvie is absolutely an animal, and he's going to be. There's no doubt he's going to be the sporty one. But they can be anything they want to be, mate. I'm not bothered.
As long as they're happy.
I've always said I keep my rigging good, Nick, just in case one of them turns out gay and they need me to support them on the pride. I'm one of the gay Mardi Gras blokes.
See you on a float one day.
Absolutely. So that's why I'm keeping the rigging okay condition.
That's awesome. And what about your future, mate? You and Jen, like, what are the plans? Like, I'm assuming you might sort of shift around a little bit at some stage, but is there a 5-year plan there or anything that you want to do?
We're going to spend our time here in the UK. Like, we're going to next week, we're flying to Pisa for a week with Luca. And that's the thing. It's just like pissing off to Melbourne. Like, you just dart. I'm darting over to Pisa in Italy, and it's not that expensive, but when you're here, you can do it. So we've got no timeline, but what we are going to do is have a hell of a lot of fun while we're here. That's about it.
Well, mate, that's pretty much the journey through your life, and that's all the serious stuff. But obviously when someone comes on my podcast, I do tend to get a little bit of dirt comes across the desk from time to time. I won't name my sources, but we do have a mutual friend, so it's probably pretty obvious where this might have come
I'm
from.
Yeah, I'm picking up where you put it down, mate.
Now, tell us about this time that you rollerbladed down the main street of Wynyard wearing a G-string and a gorilla mask.
So this is before Jackass. We used to have camcorders.
Yep.
And we go around, so it's clearly Nathan Hunt talking about, we'd all end up around at Hunty's house and on Sundays, all a bit, you know, hungover, and we'd do Sunday dares, and that was the dare. I wore a pink Sydney Hot Shots G-string, a gorilla mask, and rollerbladed from the top pub down to the wharf, and then swam across the Inglis to the golf class, just random. But we did it all on camcorder, and we used to just watch it for fun. But there was so many of these stupid dares I did.
Tell us more. It's only one he gave me. What else did you do?
Oh God, I remember I played some bloody Willie Nelson song on the back of a Hilux Ute with an afro on, up and down the main street of Wynyard, just singing to everyone. And then there was another one where I wore. I had three trophies, one of my running sashes that I'd won, and a heap of medals, and just walked up the street holding the trophies up, just high-fiving people. Just stupid, just really stupid basic stuff.
Unreal. Another thing that he tells me, you're quite a wine aficionado, but you tend to save the cheap stuff when you're catching up with your mates, and you tend to drink all their good stuff. And he said that he generally uses your stuff to cook later on. Person who gave me this info, I won't say who it was, but
So I went around to his house on the last day I was there in Tassie. I bought him a $40 bottle of Shiraz. And
he considers that cheap. He must be a pretty high roller.
He's an absolute flog, mate. He's got to remember where he came from, mate. He was drinking Jack Daniels and Cokes and smoking durries out the back of his house. And now he's living in Shearwater, drinking top end Pinot. And
you've cultured him
with his teeth whitener. So anyway,
was there any port were you drinking at the time?
Not this time.
No. Did you drink it out of a wine glass?
We had a night. Yeah, that's another one. We had a night up in Shearwater where I went up to see him, and we ran out of wine. He goes, "I've got a bit port." I said, "I'll crack it open." So we started drinking port, but we just kept drinking it like it was red wine. Yeah. And I think I mentally retarded myself.
Knocks you around, doesn't it?
I wasn't right for about 5 days. Jesus. I don't drink port like wine anymore, that's for sure.
Mate, that's all I've got for you, unless you've got anything else that you want to drop on us. You got any other stories? You can have a right of reply too, by the way, because people do listen to this podcast.
Nathan's got this bloody, he thinks he's got this reputation he needs to uphold, so I won't say too much. But no, I'm just really grateful. I've had an hour and a half to self-indulge and be the narcissist that my wife has proven that I am. So
only 80%, mate.
80%, that's it.
Yeah. Nah, it's been a pleasure, mate. Like I said, a lot of people will know a lot about your story, but I think, and I know that you're quite modest, but I think it's, you know, for what you've achieved in your life, you know, it's been great to talk about your foundations and where you came from. And I think, you know, it's obviously one of the reasons why you're a fantastic friend and a fantastic parent now as well, because of that grounding that you had in early life. And I just hope that people that listen to this have got a bit more of appreciation of where you've come from. And you know, it's not always easy. People don't always have it their own way. And
I appreciate that, mate. And that's the thing. Like, I look at, you see the poor kids getting around. You know, they could be, not that I'm anything special, but they could be absolutely anything, and they deserve to be treated the same as the rich kids, you know. So
yeah.
Good on you, mate. Really appreciate coming on. And you've got a really cool little podcast. And I don't listen to them all, but I cherry pick a few, and yeah, it's a good thing.
It's been awesome, mate. All the best, all right. And no doubt we'll probably catch up with you back in Tassie at some point, because you'll be back here again soon for one reason or another, no doubt. So
I own a block about 100 metres back from Hunt, so I'll need to build a house on it someday. So
you will.
All right, good on you, mate.
The man, the myth, the legend. Thanks, Bakesy, for coming in and telling your story. I'm sure there's plenty in there that people have learned for the first time. I think it goes to show once again that even some people achieving success or have achieved success have gone through tough times to get there, and if you keep putting one foot in front of the other, the better times will come. Bakesy's story also illustrates that it doesn't matter where you've come from, anyone can achieve successes and live a happy life. I love Bakesy's authenticity. He's a great character and he's not scared to be himself, because as the great Charles Barkley said, someone had to be me, it might as well be me. Make sure you tune in to the Better Off Dad podcast with Shannon, Nathan and James, and if you have any spare time, give these pods a mention to your friends. Thanks for listening.